This episode is sponsored in part by the Pastor Theologians Conference. Each October, the Center for Pastor Theologians hosts a one-of-a-kind interdenominational gathering of pastors and ministry leaders from across the U.S., exploring some of the most pressing issues facing the church in today's complex world. This year's conference is called Good Shepherds: Pastoral Identity and the Future of the Church. In our contemporary context, the pastorate can often be shaped by visions of leadership that sometimes overemphasize method and technique. We can find this, of course, in church growth strategies, in business-based leadership models, and in social media influencer culture. It's easy when navigating all the details to lose the plot, but October 20th to 22nd, you're invited to Chicago to renew your vision and commitment to following the way of the Good Shepherd. The Good Shepherds Conference will bring together a diverse group of pastors and ministry leaders to reflect together on how we can model pastoral ministry as under-shepherds of Jesus of Nazareth. Speakers include Kate Sonderegger, Matt O'Reilly, Doug Sweeney, Amy Peeler, and many more. Learn more and register at cptconference.com. That's cptconference.com. If we would begin to see ourselves in our proper place in this world, maybe that's what's most needed now, is that we've got some, well, gratitude for what we have been given. That would be a good beginning.
The Living Church, serving the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion since 1878. Welcome to the Living Church Podcast.
Welcome back, podcast listeners. Happy month of May. Happy Mary month. Our guest's name today is Mary. But before I tell you about her, let me just tell you a little bit about what we'll be chatting about. Today is a conversation between a pastor and a farmer. What might working the land, protecting local economies, and nurturing Christian communities have in common? Our guest is Mary Berry. She is the executive director of the Berry Center and daughter of poet, farmer, and essayist Wendell Berry. We're also going to be joined by the Reverend Clint Wilson, Wendell Berry megafan and rector of St. Francis in the Fields, Harrods Creek, Kentucky, which is also not far from the Berry Center. We'll talk today about the joy of hard work that is good work. Growing up with Wendell Berry as a dad, what was that like? Faith and farming, decisions to live with or against a given landscape. And what is home? How do you make a home? How do you dedicate yourself to it? We'll discuss the thick fabric of a place and life interwoven with neighbors, family, and seasons. And we'll ask, what does it mean to actually love your neighbor as yourself, your literal neighbor? We'll also touch on special challenges the suburbs pose to meaningful life together. Mary Berry is executive director of the Berry Center. She grew up at Lane's Landing Farm in Henry County, Kentucky. She's farmed for a living in Henry County, and she started the Berry Center in 2011 to continue the agricultural work of John Berry Sr. and his sons, author Wendell Berry and former Kentucky State Senator, the late John M. Berry Jr. The Berry Center focuses on issues confronting small farming families in Kentucky and around the country. Mary is also going to be a speaker at our June Church Growth Conference, where she'll be in dialogue with Dr. Ellen Davis on agrarianism, scripture, and monastic wisdom on place, cultivation, and community. Would love you to check it out. Go to livingchurch.org/events. Get your tickets soon because the conference starts in the first week of June. I also encourage you to learn more about the work of the Berry Center and events that they have coming up in the summer and the fall. You can go to berrycenter.org for that. We'll provide links for all this in the show notes. You can also find on their website their Home Place Meat program, which Mary mentions in the podcast today. They offer grass-fed beef raised on family farms, and they do ship in case you don't live in Kentucky. Speaking of raising, we may raise as many questions today as we hear answers, but we think and we hope you enjoy the conversation. I guess the only housekeeping item is whether you guys have questions for me.
How much were the royalties off of the podcast views?
Mm.
Clint is joking about royalties. No money passes hands.
Oh, I understand. Believe me, I'm the daughter of a poet.
You get it.
I know that there are no royalties.
Today, we will be hearing port royalties.
Oh, that's good. We'll keep that one in, Clint. We'll keep that one in. Mary, Clint, it is great to have you on the podcast today. Welcome.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here, be with you.
We're going to have some major Wendell Berry fans listening in to this episode, like major, major raging Wendell Berry fans like Clint. And then we'll also have some folks who aren't as familiar with his work like myself. So I thought that I would bring Clint in to help me out. He'll take one angle. I'll take another angle on some of the things we'd love to ask you today, Mary. And Clint, I thought I'd just let you kick us off with orienting us to Wendell Berry's legacy and this whole thought world and philosophy that defines the agrarian life.
That's great. And to be clear, I mean, there are people who know a lot more than me about your father, Mary, and also the work that you do at the center. But it's such a privilege to be able to spend this time with you today
and to
hear about your work. So we thought a good place to begin was with a deeper understanding of what does the term agrarian mean?
Mm-hmm.
And how has your father's work been so important within that tradition of agrarianism?
My father has spoken of agrarianism as a way of thinking based on the health of land. And I know enough about the way he thinks to know that that means thinking about trying to think as wholly as possible about everything. I was just reading a quotation of his this morning about agrarianism, actually, and let me read it to you. Quote, "I believe that this contest between industrialism and agrarianism now defines the most fundamental human difference, for it divides not just two nearly opposite concepts of agriculture and land use, but also two nearly opposite ways of understanding ourselves, our fellow creatures, and our world." I mean, it seems to me that we're going to have to make a choice. And probably it first starts with thinking hard about the way we live now. We've all heard it said many times that we should live an examined life. I think this is a good first step.
You know, I suspect that your father didn't sit down and just read you that essay or, you know, from his materials directly. What was it like growing up with Wendell Berry for a father, and how have his commitments come to influence your own work and worldview?
Well, first of all, my father actually did sit down and read us things, read us all kinds of things. My mother has been called by people, I mean, including my father, his best editor. Certainly my father says she's his best editor. And so I'm not sure that the goal was always that my brother and I would be listening, but the works were read on a regular basis in our kitchen. Mom and Dad worked together on those pieces, sometimes passionate conversations. I'll call them passionate because I'm trying to save my family's reputation here. So I listened to it all from the time I can remember. Did I read it myself? No, I didn't read it myself until I went to college. But when people ask me what it was like to have Daddy as my father, I often think it's helpful to answer a question like that if you have something to compare it to. And of course, I have nothing to compare it to. Daddy's always been my father. But I can tell you that I remember very early as a little girl thinking that I'm lucky to have the parents I've got. And it was clear to me that some people didn't have parents that were as loving and funny and involved and hard-headed and so on as mine were. So I've always been glad to be my parents' daughter. There's not been a moment, really, that I have not been glad. Now, there were many moments when I was very young that I made my parents' life kind of miserable, because I think the thing that I said the most while I was growing up was, I did not choose to live this way.
Wow.
So because it occurred to me when I was about 12 years old that mom and dad did everything the hardest way possible. And I could not see why that was necessary and why it was being forced on me. But you can see then the predicament I was in because I never really disagreed with them. I never have really disagreed with them, except maybe that I should stay out later or do whatever I wanted when I was 16. But it's been an extraordinary thing to know my parents well, to know my grandparents well, to know Henry County well. I can't really separate myself from those long, good relationships that I've had with the land and the people here, neighbors, friends, and certainly family.
I think the phrase that you just used that is probably most evocative for me so far is that they did things the hardest way possible. I have a feeling that has to do with the choice to live according to an agrarian philosophy of life. Could you give us a picture, you know, a concrete picture of what it meant for them to choose to live the hardest way possible and why this was so valuable?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because it gives me a chance to say a 12-year-old's idea of the hardest way possible leaves
it's
out
like folding
a lot.
Their clothes.
It's like, I don't really want to work in the garden or put in hay or clean out stalls or whatever we were doing. And I certainly thought that I was being badly treated and that other people were clearly living easier, better lives than I was. My parents loved raising 85% of their own food. My parents loved working on their farm. My parents loved being a part of that community and so on. So there's a big difference between hard work and drudgery. And they were doing good work. Daddy always, all my life, would write half the day and work on the farm half the day, unless the ox was in the ditch and he needed to be doing other things. I just learned to think very early in my life that physical work was important and necessary and good and exalted, if you will. I never heard in my household, you know, people say things like just a housewife or just a farmer or just in anything. I mean, they were doing the work that they loved to do. It was good.
There's a quote from Jaber Crow, you know, one of your father's characters, where he says to feel at home in a place, you have to have some prospect of staying there. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if, as you were growing up, at what point did the hard stuff become the faithful stuff for you? You know, so I'm thinking as well of a story that I don't remember exactly where it is, but it's an essay of your father's where I believe he's talking about your daughter,
Katie.
Where he says they spent a day out together and it was cold and kind of bitter, and they sat at the end of the day together in a wagon, and she turned to him at some point and said, "Wendell, isn't this fun?" or something to that effect, right?
Granddaddy, and it was, I think, it was isn't a, this fun?
It was a kind of signpost to her experiencing not just something that was hard, but that was faithful. Mm-hmm. And did you ever have moments like that growing up?
Oh, of course I did. I had many moments like that. And many of the moments, when I was chafing maybe a bit about the work we were doing at home, then we were working with neighbors who I love dearly and love to work with. And I raised my children the same way. My children were born starting in the early 80s, kind of at the end of the agrarian culture that was here and thriving until probably around 1990. You know, my mother is from California. We lived in California for a year when my father went to Stanford. We lived in Europe for a year when my father had a Guggenheim Fellowship. I was 3 and turned 4 there. We lived in New York City for a couple of years. I went to kindergarten there. Daddy was teaching at NYU. And then he was offered a job at the University of Kentucky. They came home and bought the farm where they are right as we speak today, they thought of it as a weekend place. And it was my mother who said to my father, "You don't want to spend weekends there. You want to live there." And of course he did, and they did, and they've been living there ever since. So my father came home, my mother made a home, which is an interesting difference and something worth talking about, I think, because it's such a hopeful idea for people who can't stay where they're from. My first memories, which are very early, I remember very young. I think maybe because we lived so many places, I can differentiate memories. From the time I was tiny, I just wanted to get back to Henry County. And I've traveled some. I certainly thought that I might need to live somewhere else. But I was very glad to be able to come home to live and farm when I left school, when I graduated from school. And I can see that every generation might need to somehow choose it for themselves. They might have to have a moment somehow, if it's not going to school and coming home, if it's just a moment that you think, no, this is for me. I choose this now. Every generation, I think, has to do that. There's strength in that. But I never wanted, I'm just one of those people. I was just born to be here. So here I am.
Well, let's pivot a little bit and consider, you know, that faith and farming have historically been intertwined. And how do you see agrarian principles shaping church communities today?
I see what the Port Royal Baptist Church is trying to do. I see what the preachers there are trying to do, and to incorporate the growing season, the weather, what the farming members of their community are doing. That's always mentioned and alive at that church. There are meals cooked with local produce, local meat, and so on and so forth. So I know something about that. I know that there's a real effort being made. That's a country church in a little tiny town of Port Royal. It's the church that my father refers to as your mother's church. He goes and sits where his great grandfather sat and enjoys seeing his family and so. But frankly, I will say that I don't see a lot of what I think is meaningful involvement in other churches with an agrarian, I hate to use the word philosophy, but agrarian thinking. But I will qualify that by saying I've known two churches well in my life, only two. So I just will say, I think the church could think much harder about its role in these efforts to take care of what we have been given.
Along those lines, what are some of the agrarian values that could play a role in revitalizing faith communities?
You know, since I've known that I was going to do this podcast, I've been thinking about that question. I get asked it a lot, one way or another. I mean, just how can people take part? What can they do?
Yeah.
And of course, the answers I've been given are the answers my father would have given, did give when he was still engaging in a public life. They can shop as close to home as possible and so on and so forth. But I've gotten kind of dissatisfied with that answer, although I don't think the answer is wrong. I think maybe I'm going to refer to, and I looked this up just so I could read it this morning. It's Matthew 22:36, and you already know what I'm going to read, but teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law? To love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. But then, love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. And I think if we would take that seriously, love your neighbor as yourself, take it seriously, then we would begin to have to grow from the ground up in a different way than we've been going for decades, generations now. Love your neighbor as yourself. It's very clear to me that people who will abuse land will abuse other people because it's inherent. So what does that mean? It's hard. But I'm gonna continue to think on that. Mm. Because what people want to hear is that there are things they can do, there's a checklist or something. And of course, we all, I mean, there is a checklist. I do think it matters. If you search out what's good, what's close, what's transparent, and support it. Any church, anybody can do that.
You know, Mary, I so appreciate hearing you say what you know, but then also hearing you say what you
I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Because I've had these conversations with friends who really, who appreciate your father's work, but they have their contexts, the contexts they're working in are far more urban or very underprivileged. So they really struggle with understanding how just something like your personal shopping choices is going to be loving your neighbor. And like you said, your personal shopping choices, that is one tick box. That's just one thing that we can be thinking about and being thoughtful and prayerful about. But you know, the fact that you say there's more to think about, there's more to consider, I'm not quite satisfied with that answer. I'm curious whether that dissatisfaction might have something to do with the way that personal shopping choices are still tied to consumerism in a way. I mean, it's sort of like, do I consume this way or that way?
Well, first of all, the answer I gave was to the church as an institution. So if St. Francis serves a meal, then where does the food come from that is being served? That's what, you know, there is something that a church can do. I remember years ago at Newcastle, at the Newcastle Baptist Church, when Walmart opened, it was an actual decision to make that we would continue to shop with our friends at the independent stores closest to us. We had to make that decision, which is kind of shocking to me, but we did.
Yeah.
Because it's cheaper to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
Of course, it doesn't end up cheaper. I mean, when all your choices are gone and Walmart's the only thing left, how many choices do you still have? So yes, I am dissatisfied with anything that turns out to be kind of a passive answer. Shopping, personal shopping choices. Yeah, you can make better ones, but it's hard. It's hard to make better ones, almost impossible. So I'm looking for an answer that's not passive, that actually asks for engagement with the mind and the heart. So, and you've got me in the middle of just trying to figure out how to answer that question well.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm so glad you are. I can't wait to hear what comes out on the other side.
Yeah, me neither.
Mary, I'm thinking of that passage of scripture, you know, the great commandment that you referenced. And do you think that part of the problem is people just don't actually know how to be a neighbor anymore, to be embedded within a kind of holistic social fabric, to be given to one another? And, you know, I read an article recently, a Baptist pastor named Kyle Childress, who talked about a friend of his who said that a lot of times, you know, within his context of the Baptist church, you know, you'd get people coming out of seminary, young pastors who were going to build the kingdom of God with bulldozers, he said. And that was the sensibility that he had of these these young pastors. Ministry can be done in a way that is just as destructive as the kind of corporate imposing of a new store onto a community. And so we don't really know what it means to be embedded within a community, to be a neighbor. And how have you learned to be a neighbor?
What I am is an inheritor. And it comes from my grandfather and my farming forebears that believed in the importance of working landscapes, working people. My vision that sustains me every day is just, it's narrow, really. But the idea that Louisville, so close, could be fed by its surrounding landscape as much as possible. So nobody has to ask me about coffee or oranges. I'm so tired of that question. But as much as possible, making the landscape around Louisville healthier, thereby making Louisville healthier. I mean, it's just, it's so clearly the right way to go. Years ago, at the start of Louisville Farm to Table, which has since come to nothing, my father met with the then mayor and another prominent citizen in Louisville, and he opened the meeting saying to the then mayor, this was right after 9/11, what if we have an emergency like that here? Where are people going to get their food? I mean, our supply lines are tricky. Most of us are urban. You asked me, Amber, about your urban friends. Well, something like 14 or 15% of us now live in the countryside. Fewer than 1% of us farm. Fewer than 0.75% farm. I think I am a great believer that the truth will make you free. So let's just tell the truth here. We've got a serious problem. But once you begin to deal with the truth, then hope comes so much more easily. Dodging the truth is what brings despair, as far as I'm concerned. Certainly has been true in my own life. So, Clint, I don't even remember what the question was that I've talked around. What does it mean to be a neighbor? Okay, well, I think that what it meant to me growing up was that I just worked my way into neighborliness because we were all working together. We were sharing the same agrarian calendars. We were going to church together. I mean, it was everything. So now what does it take for people living in the suburbs to become neighborly? I think to be neighbors, to be a community, means that it's more than just getting together for social occasions, for enjoying each other, for potlucks and so on, although that's all important. There's got to be more. There's got to be some kind of people need each other. They need to need each other and need to know it. How you make that happen when people are leaving home every morning and coming home every evening and living their work lives away from home, that's a hard question. I think it has to be done, you know, household by household by household, probably. I don't think big solutions are going to do it. So that's not a very good answer, but I don't really have a good answer. I will tell you what I have seen. We have a program here called Our Home Place Meet, and I have seen the group of farmers in that program go from silent in a room to just waiting to see what we had to say and to being so talkative during meetings that you can't keep them quiet. So we're seeing a return to the community that I grew up in. And that's happened quickly. So with just a little help, people can heal and begin to come together, I think. But they have to have common ground.
Hey, everybody. I'd love to tell you about our next Living Church conference that you don't want to miss. It's in St. Louis in November, and it's called Awe and Presence, a conference on worship and the arts. What do worship, going to church, or the beauty of the Christian liturgy have to do with real life? You can explore with us through art, literature, music, and history how sacraments and sacred rhythms usher us into the awe and presence of the one who is good, true, and beautiful, and forms our lives to his. Speakers include Malcolm Geit, W. David O. Taylor, Abram Van Engen, Grace Hammond, and Matthew Ulver on poetry, prayer, the body in worship, what it means to worship with the church of the past, and understanding the story we're in. Go to livingchurch.org/events for more info and to register, or click the link in the show notes today. And if you register now, you can get a 15% off early bird special. That's livingchurch.org/events, or click the link in the show notes. You know, as you were talking, Mary, it occurred to me, and I wonder what you think about this too, Clint, but I wonder whether it's even most challenging for people in suburban contexts to learn or relearn neighborliness in the sense of meeting and discovering need for one another and being fruitful for one another and cultivating for one another rather than relationships based on buying and selling. So, I mean, if less than 1% of people in our country produce food,
And the vast majority of us live in places where we really can't grow much, or we don't grow much, and we just buy. But instead, how do in those spaces, particularly spaces where you drive to work and then come home and pull your car into your garage and you may say, hey, but that's it, to become fruitful for one another, to sense the need for one another. Gosh, that seems like a hard job that someone's going to need to figure out.
Well, and especially, Amber, I mean, in the absence of the spaces and the places that provide the common ground that you mentioned, Mary, which you all have been able to cultivate at the Wendelberry Center, our culture is only further sinking into people being atomized into individuals, as opposed to being persons embedded within an ecology and you know, a community. And it just seems to me that the idea of a common ground is becoming increasingly more difficult to inhabit, to embody, which makes me wonder, Mary, if you might say a little bit more about the Wendelberry Center more comprehensively, about what you all are doing beyond the example that you already provided, and how might that help us?
Well, the Berry Center was started in 2011 to continue my family's advocacy for small farmers and for their communities. And really, the work of my grandfather, John Berry Sr., is really the inspiration, maybe, because he and his friends put an economy in place that supported good farming, and it lasted for decades. And we have, with our home place meat, attempted to at least use the principles of that program to make that work for farmers now so that they can afford to farm. But I accept completely my father's idea in The Unsettling of America that we don't have just an agricultural problem, we have a cultural problem in this country. So we have addressed that as wholly as we could. We're building from what we already have and adding to it and keeping it solid and safe. A farmer I know said of one of Dad's books, he's told our history and he's told it with respect, and we're not used to respect. I mean, that's one thing you have to remember about country people, is that they felt like if you were smart and were going to succeed in this world, you'd have to leave a place like Henry County. You couldn't succeed here. If I'd had any sense at all, I would have worried about anybody coming to work at the Berry Center when I started it in 2011. What's happened is that these amazing people, most of them much younger than I am, are working every day to solve the problems that need to be solved. And everything we're doing is replicable. And we've talked to people all over the country about what we're doing, and would like to offer as much help and do offer as much help as we can.
I'm just thinking a lot of this is not rocket science. It's just having intentionality around doing it.
No, it's possible that I'm against rocket science. But let me say one thing about the way we've worked here. And the way we've worked here, I learned directly from my father, who said, good work starts with an inventory of what you have to work with. And so we took an inventory of what we had. We still had the remnants of a good agrarian culture. We have a well-watered, fertile landscape. Too much water at the moment, but well-watered. We have access to urban markets and so on and so forth. We still have a landscape broken into small farms, although we're losing it pretty quickly, but we still have it. I wonder if that would work for churches to begin to think about where they are and what they can do in the place they are. What's here now and what should be here? What's missing? What was here that's not here anymore? Those kinds of questions.
I'm just thinking of something you said earlier, Mary, when you were describing the difference between your father landing at Port Royal and your mother landing at Port Royal. For your father, it was coming home. For your mother, it was making a home. And I think of people who were maybe even born separated from the land. The difference between coming home for people who know the land and have this intrinsic, this heritage, and people who are making a home in suburban or urban spaces, or maybe in rural spaces where they're not currently as in touch with place as they could be. I'm curious how you've both seen the wisdom of small landholders applied to people who are not small landholders. You know, like, how have you seen people who don't do this for a living take this up and learn some of this wisdom and integrate it into their lives in other places?
I was thinking earlier, Mary, as you were talking about the idea that in the kingdom of God, a small thing is never a small thing. I'm thinking about the emphasis of a lot of your father's writings on, you know, there's no small place. All places are connected in a sense.
All places are sacred.
Yes. Part of the inherent difficulty is that you need to cultivate skills of reading a place, and that takes a lot of time and patience. And so you have to cultivate the skill of being a part of an economy, an ecology, a community. And doing so requires more time than most people may be willing to give. I'm thinking of clergy. You know, there was a sense historically that clergy could have an understanding of the identity of their vocation wrapped up in their order, right? If they were ordained or if they were part of a monastic community, they could still be uprooted with respect to place and have an enduring sense of their identity. But there were others who said, no, we're going to be in this place, and we're going to move to this place, and we're going to pack up all our belongings in our casket and go there. And then it took a lifetime to understand what going there meant for them. And I'm not sure that we live in a world where many people think in that way any longer. No. That I'm going to go there and be there.
No.
Really be there. So, I mean, in our context, I mean, I'm only 5.5 years in here at St. Francis in the Fields, and I feel like I'm just beginning to get going and to scratch beneath the surface of knowing people, of being known, and of trying to implement some practices that run with the grain of this place, as opposed to imposing practices that are, in a sense, foreign to who this community has been. So for a practical example would be, you know, we've always been a church that's cared a lot about prayer. We have not always been a place that's been deeply rooted in the patterns of the daily offices as they show up in the Book of Common Prayer, morning prayer and evening prayer. And so we've started to inhabit those practices. And inhabiting those practices actually draw you into a way of being in the world that calls you to slow down, you know, when you have to read through a bunch of psalms with a group of people, and to do that together, not just, you know, in your chair with your coffee and such. And I'm thinking about sitting in our chapel here and reading through the psalms and looking out the window over the course of seasons and seeing a tree that has no leaves on it in the winter. In spring, flower, white blossoms, and then the blossoms fall, and there are leaves that come on it. And you see in the winter the bird's nest, and eventually you see the little birds, you know. And I mean, you're embedded within a world that it actually takes time to attend to. And being a part of the rhythm of the daily office, morning prayer or evening prayer itself, actually cultivates within you the discipline to be attuned, to notice, to pay attention, as opposed to just kind of running through life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, morning prayer being something that happens depending on the sun coming up, and evening prayer,
yeah, that's right,
something that happens depending on the sun going down. So even the rhythms of prayer being connected to the stability as well as the changes that we're given in nature and as creatures, I think is something that I don't think about much. What are you thinking, Mary?
I'm just thinking that I'm hopeful that from that sort of practice comes some kind of humility that I think that's maybe what's most, gosh, I don't really have the chops to say this, but maybe that's what's most needed now, is that we've got some, well, gratitude for what we have been given, our one given life, our given world, but also the humility to do the right work and good work and to live well on this on this land. I think people have lost the idea that we are a land-based economy. I think that really, with all of the technology and so on and clouds and all of that, I think people really don't understand that everything we depend on, that we use, comes from the ground, everything. You don't get something from nothing. So I think if we would begin to see ourselves in our proper place in this world, that would be a good beginning.
So I was a church planter for a couple of years in Denver, Colorado, and led a small group book study with some parishioners where we read your father's book, The Way of Ignorance. And I'm wondering if that really gets at what you're talking about with respect to humility.
Yeah. And since I was very young, the scriptures that talk about mystery have always been most meaningful to me. You only know in part. Someday you'll know in full, but you only know in part. I think that's just, it's wonderful to think, especially during troubled times, and most of the times are troubled one way or the other, to think we don't know everything. We can't know everything. My father's written extensively about too much devotion, really, given to this idea of the future, what's surely going to happen when we have no idea what's going to happen. We need to plant the right amount of potatoes that we know we'll need this year. But other than that, that's about all you can do. So just in terms of how people begin to think differently, maybe to begin a journey that leads to contentment and joy, is to begin to check what we really need, what really is meaningful for us, what kind of work do we really want to do with one given life. But I have watched my parents. They are certainly not narrow people, but their joy and fascination has been that 60 acres that they've lived on all these years. They've watched it carefully. I just spent a couple of hours with Daddy at the camp the other day, and he is endlessly fascinated with what's outside that 40-paned window. Endlessly fascinated. I think we can all do that. I think it's harder for some of us than others, but I think we can begin. We can begin the work of satisfaction and interest and so on.
Yeah.
I also think we can all do the right thing that's right in front of us to do. We don't have to wait. We don't need permission. Another thing my father says is you can do the right thing that's right in front of you to do if you're in prison. Just do it. Don't wait. And that really, I'm most grateful to my family for, is that idea that what's happened to the place I love the most in the world has not been inevitable. It's been destruction by design. If a bad design has destroyed it, well, we'll find a better one. There is a better one. It exists. It exists. It's been given to us, as a matter of fact.
Thank you, Mary. That was really beautiful. I do wonder how we might, as a discipline, learn to take a greater sense of joy, to find a deeper sense of joy woven into creation itself, to be attuned and to listen to that joy and to be surprised by it as we receive it as a gift. Norman Wiersbe at Duke Divinity talks about the kind of disincarnate form of Christianity, this way of being in the world where we're not really in the world. And it seems to me that so much of what you're calling us towards is a model of being where we are, being who we are with the people around us, and attending to those relationships in ways that are both intentional and costly, but at the end of the day, are full of joy if we attend to them with integrity.
Yeah. I mean, what you're both saying is something that aligns with a prayer that I've found in my own heart recently, which is, you know, Lord, make us a people of contentment. Could you imagine if the United States were a place where people were content to live small lives? I don't know. We probably always will want to invent things and all this, and that's, you know, that's great. But I mean, Yeah, just a sense of not always needing to reach beyond what we're given and then compete for what we don't have. What if we could be a people of contentment?
Well, we ought to be a people who can count the cost. To use an easy example, I'm speaking on one now. What will this laptop computer do to our communities? What will the phone that's hauling around all the time do to our communities? Well, I've clearly got a computer and I've got a phone, so I'm implicit. We're all implicit. None of us can get out of it. I mean, there's no place for self-righteousness here because none of us can get out of this economy. But there are places that if we would be satisfied to limit ourselves to what we can actually do, there are places that I think would be especially meaningful to, I mean, I speak to people all over the country and a lot of young people, and they're interested in this idea of regional economies, of local economies. Now, they're interested and they're young and they don't know a lot about what that's going to take, and it's going to take a lot. But I say to these groups, if we don't have regional economies, then people will have no power and the land will have no voice, and we're going to stay that way. But we don't have to stay that way. And we don't have to stay a people as separated as we are. What if we began to be people who come together about the health of land, the land that sustains us, that is right around us? I mean, people in Louisville are so cut off from the sources of their electricity that most of them probably, I'd be willing to bet, have not seen the mountaintop removal in eastern Kentucky. They just haven't seen it. I mean, I'm willing to go to a protest, and I will go to more protests as time goes on, I'm sure. But protests aren't enough. We've got to go to work. So all the movements that have been going on my whole life, but the last couple of years in particular, I keep thinking, as long as the economy rolls on, as long as we have a land-destroying, people-destroying economy, we're not going to make the changes we've got to make. But we, the people, can make the changes. We're doing it here, and there's nothing special about us except that we have a vision. It's great. It's hopeful. I have no trouble with hope. I have no trouble at all. I have some trouble with patience, but no trouble with hope.
I've been speaking today with the Reverend Clint Wilson, rector of St. Francis in the Fields Episcopal Church and host of our Living Church Conference in June. And we've been speaking today with Mary Berry, the executive director of the Berry Center and one of the speakers at our upcoming conference. Mary, Clint, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been fun.
It was great. Thank you so much.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Living Church Podcast, a ministry of the Living Church. If you haven't yet, go on and tune into our bonus episode that launched a few days ago, a conversation about the legacy of Pope Francis with Father Martin Brown from the Vatican's Dicastery for Promoting Christian Unity. We may even get a mini film review of Conclave in there. In 2 weeks, we sit down with Dr. Abigail Favalli and pastoral consultant Peter Valk on gender, transgender anthropology, and how even churches with a traditional theology of sexuality can care well for and learn from parishioners and neighbors who identify as trans. Until then, our producer is Leslie Thompson. I'm Amber Noel, your host, and it's been good to be with you. Peace.